You know, it was Captain Kirk. He once said, space, the final frontier. In a moment, a very special 3 hours with Sir Charles Schulz III on Coast to Coast AM. Sir Charles Schulz worked at Martin Marietta Aerospace for 10 years on weapon systems and computer-based automated test equipment. He wrote the nuclear EMP test software for the Pershing II missile system, worked on the Patriot and Copperhead tank killer and advanced attack helicopter systems. And Sir Charles has performed research under Grant on nuclear fusion, was knighted, and received a long-term grant for his present research in robotics and artificial intelligence. He has written many technical publications and magazine articles on space, astronomy, the atmosphere, and space resource development. He is rapidly becoming a regular here on Coast to Coast. My pleasure. First time I've talked with Sir Charles Schulz. Hello, Sir Charles. How are you?
Great, George, and thanks. It will be our first show together.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to this. It's always fun and exciting to break new ground. And I've had a chance to listen to a couple of your chats with Art, and you bring some very fascinating topics to the table, Sir Charles.
Well, thank you. Let's see if we can expand everyone's mind and horizons just a little bit tonight.
Absolutely. Tell me a little bit more about yourself, just for my own benefit, how you got into this field of science and now you're doing what you're doing.
Well, I've always been fascinated by science. I mean, I've always had a drive to know how things work and where things came from. And so it was just a very natural thing for me to look at space and science and technology, and I eventually ended up working in the fields because it was something that I enjoyed a great deal, and I felt I was able to make some contributions to.
Did it start as a boyhood wonder, like it did with so many of us?
Well, yeah, you know, I've always had chemistry and electronics components around, studied rocks, great interest in anything mathematical and scientific, and so it just sort of bloomed. Early on in my career, I ended up in aerospace, and it's just taken off from there.
You got to be happy with the fact that NASA says they plan to go back May of 2008 to fix the Hubble.
Well, that is an interesting thought. I'm not necessarily in agreement that it's the best course to pursue. There are some risks involved, but, you know, now that they've decided to do it, let's hope they do it properly.
Do you think it was worth the? It's going to be worth the $900 million, and I'm sure that number will go higher by the time we get up there.
Well, I know that there are a number of better space telescopes available and that we have a lot of them on the drawing board that could be completed pretty rapidly and get into, you know, deployment and in operation. I don't know if $900 million is really, you know, it's worth the price tag, but there's a great deal of historical interest, and Hubble has a long-running service life, and a lot of people depend on it. So perhaps they'll get what they're after.
Do you see space travel moving toward privatization?
Oh, absolutely. It's just like any other form of transportation. The only thing that has been holding us up in the past primarily is destinations. There's nothing really close to the Earth that you can get to easily and cheaply. And, of course, government competition has greatly squelched a lot of private development up until just recently when it's been demonstrated that private industry can do it just as effectively and far more cheaply than governments can at this time.
Will there be restrictions, regulations on those privateers? Here's an example. What if a company decides, hey, you know what, we're going to get into weaponry in space. We're going to do some of those kinds of things. Do you think governments will put a kibosh on those companies?
Well, yes. Right now, governments only like themselves to be in charge of the weapons, and of course, we really don't want to see
yes.
a proliferation of weapons in space. So far, space has remained a very clean environment, and conflicts, as we know them on the ground, really haven't occurred there. And I don't really want to see an expansion of that sort. So you can believe that there's going to be a great deal of effort to suppress the development of private weapon systems in space, certainly.
How do you see the future of space and space travel, Sir Charles, let's say over the next 20 years?
Well, I do expect within the next 20 years we're going to see a huge growth in the private sector, because most of the government efforts have been rather narrow or aimed at specific tasks, and the private sector has a lot of other things in mind. We can use space for a lot of reasons that are generally not available to the government, and what I really see is the growth in the private industry will far outstrip anything in the government sector.
By the way, I want to invite everybody to get up to the coasttocoastam.com website, take a look at the graphics and the pictures, the images that Sir Charles has sent us, and there's a link to his website, xenotechresearch.com. We'll be talking about Mars in a moment during our program. The fascination that you have brought to the table here with space and looking at these images, and we'll dive a little deeper in them. But do you find them yourself now, Sir Charles, or do people bring them to your attention?
Well, most of the research I do myself, and I have to admit that some of the best images in the last 3 or 4 months have been brought forward by a number of people who visit my site and have become regular correspondents with me. So, you know, there's an equal helping at this point of what I find and what others find. And, of course, you'll notice that every time somebody else makes a finding, I'm certain to give them credit on the site because there's more than enough for everyone to go around.
Absolutely. You know, I've contemplating what it would be like to do a broadcast in space. I don't know if we put up the funds to go up there and do a one-time program like that, but a lot of people are starting to plunk down a couple $100,000 for the rights to go up into space at the same time. And, of course, we know people are paying millions to the Russians to go up into space. Do you see those costs coming down dramatically for the average person?
Oh, yes, I do. As the expansion in the private sector occurs, the cost will definitely come down. Right now, the only reason it's so expensive is because most of the systems that are in flight today have been developed by military and government organizations, and there was a large price tag associated with them at the time. Fortunately, there's a great deal of Russian hardware that's really gone into more or less mass production, almost like an automobile line, and it brings the cost down significantly. From what I understand, the cost of a single passenger on one of the Soyuz flights pretty much pays for all of its operation.
Well, that's smart business on their part, isn't it?
Well, yes, it is, and you can expect to see much more of that in the coming times. Right now, there are many different packages that are offered to private citizens for space travel and tourism, and, of course, we know of the 4 space tourists that have already flown, and there's a lot of interesting information out there about people who are interested in space tourism and flying their own hardware in space, and so we're going to cover a lot of that tonight. I've got a great deal of information about that. I think people will find really fascinating to find out what's available.
Great. At what time are they going to take us around the moon? Is that going to happen?
Oh, well, no. That's a very good question, and already there is a package offered. Now, you have to be rather rich to do it, but for the cost of roughly $100 million, there is a trip to lunar orbit and back that's being offered by the same company that's done all the space tourism up to this point. SpaceAdventures.com is their website, and they've already flown 4 tourists to the International Space Station, all aboard Russian rockets as the launching vehicle, and they are also announcing that they have possibilities of a spacewalk. So typically a space tourist will pay about $20 million for a flight to the ISS, and if for $35 million, they can have a 90-minute spacewalk thrown in as part of the deal.
I wonder if they would hold my check until after I returned. I would post-date it.
I don't know. I think they get pretty curious about whether it's good or not up front.
Isn't that amazing, though, that some people, and I'm sure they've got the wherewithal, would plunk down that kind of money to go up into space?
Well, if you've made that sort of money that you can spare that, and you've done just about everything already, and, you know, a lot of people who are extremely wealthy have pretty much done all the thrilling things in their lives that are available to them, then this is just one more notch in the belt, you know, a really thrilling experience, something unique that you can do. And I think in part it's just a demonstration of the fact that you are capable of doing it. You know, there's always the effect that people have of showing off what they're capable of. But, you know, there's a great thrill of adventure there. And the positive aspect of it is when they fund a flight like this, they're actually helping the development of commercial space flight for everyone.
No, there's no doubt about that. They are pioneers, I think, in getting all of us one day to be able to do that. Do you envision, you know, I fly back and forth between Los Angeles and St. Louis quite often. Do you envision the day that we will be in a plane or some kind of vehicle, we'll go up 70, 80,000 feet in the air from, let's say, L.A. and plunk right down in St. Louis. So what normally would have taken 4 hours may take 45 minutes. Is that going to happen?
Well, yes. There was a lot of work on hypersonic transports and ballistic suborbital vehicles that would allow you to get anywhere in the world in 90 minutes to 2 hours. All of the legwork has been done, and a great deal of hardware has been tested, and it's a known quantity. We know, in the same way that we could in the past deliver, let's say, a defensive missile system or you know, a ballistic missile, we could easily set up a craft that would carry passengers in the same way for completely peaceful purposes. So, yes, you can expect that once approval is reached and enough passengers who can afford it are available, we will probably see transatmospheric or ballistic flights that can get you anywhere in an hour or two.
And it's all about time, Charles, isn't it? It's all
well, yes,
about
it is.
Saving time.
you know, that's the one thing we have in our lives, and we don't know how much of it we have, and it's a real shame to waste it time.
You know, it's funny because you look at the development of cell phones, and I remember owning one of those big Motorolas that looked like those military phones, and they've gotten smaller and smaller and smaller. So we're with computers, it's speed and memory. With cell phones, it's the size of this thing and its capability and the things that it can do. With the space flight and with the airfare, like you're right, it is. It's whittling away time so that, you know, your day isn't spent on a plane. It's all a convenience. How far away are we talking about for those things to be a reality?
Well, we know that already there is space tourism, and right now, if somebody were to come up with a $35 million, they could easily become a space-walking space tourist. The lunar flight could actually be pulled off pretty quickly in a matter of months or so. I would say no more than 2 years if somebody came up with $100 million. We're going to see probably transatmospheric, day-to-day transports probably within the next 10 years.
What would prohibit some private company from going to the moon, let's say, and claiming that they own part of it? I know there's been some enactment between governments.
Right.
But, I mean, technically, don't you think it might hold up in court, you know, finders keepers? And, you know, they basically said, look, we flew to the moon. We own this parcel of land now.
Well, actually, there are some rules and regulations that prevent that from happening. If you go online, there's something called the Archimedes Registry, where people can stake claims on celestial bodies, just as prospectors and miners did in the Old West. And in the registry, you'll find that there are different types of claims that you can stake. The weakest claim is simply to point out a plot of land on some body and say, you know, I want that. A stronger claim would be to land a vehicle on it. And the strongest claim, of course, would be to go there in person and stick some flags in the ground and say, I'm taking this territory. To a degree, that could be done, and nobody's yet demonstrated that, actually. And some will argue that when NASA sent astronauts to the moon, we actually ended up owning the moon. That's not necessarily true, because governments are prohibited at this point from making a claim of that sort. Private individuals or companies, on the other hand, might be able to circumvent those rulings, because let's imagine you went to the moon or Mars and you staked out a claim somewhere, and let's say you even filed with the Archimedes Registry. I'm taking 50,000 acres of, you know, Meridiani, let's say. Who could go there and stop you?
Exactly. It's fascinating. I think this is going to be a real legal mess one day.
Well, it will. And, you know, understand that anytime there's a territory that's unclaimed or even a frontier of any sort, if people can afford to get there and they want to badly enough, they will manage to do it one way or another. So this is going to happen.
People are clamoring now to send the artifacts and items, personal items, into space. Can anybody do it, or do you have to have contacts, connections?
Believe it or not, it's to the point where anyone can do it. And in fact, on the last show that I did, Robert Bigelow was on the guest list for the first hour, and
right.
He has launched a small test space station of his own, and he's planning on launching another system sometime in January. He offers a plan called Fly Your Stuff, and on that plan, you can send up small personal items for a very nominal fee. And in fact, there are a number of companies that are offering this sort of thing at this time. It's something that anybody can do. All you have to do is locate the companies, figure out how much you're willing to spend to fly something, and go ahead and make the arrangements. It's all very above board and easy to do, and anyone can do it.
What are people prepared to send up there? What aside from, I guess, the ashes of their dearly departed ones?
Well, yes, that was one very odd thing. People wanted to send the ashes of the deceased, people that they had known who, let's say, wanted to travel in space but never had the opportunity. Other items that end up getting sent are things like photographs, knickknacks, you know, small personal items. And understand that these things go, and they're really very unlikely ever to return. There was even talk of crashing a capsule full of remains into the moon with, you know, a few dozen capsules of ashes. And it would be like a permanent haven for that material, those ashes of the deceased. But the other things that people tend to send are just small personal or vanity items, such as photographs or, you know, small items of their own, and they can say, yes, I sent something into space. So it's right now it's sort of trivial. On the other end of the spectrum, there are serious university research programs and small business programs where they want to do research in space, and they would like to be able to fly a small satellite that can do their research or produce novel materials in microgravity. And so these are the largest up-and-coming group of customers in terms of serious payload.
Are we going to have a problem in space, Charles, in terms of too many objects up there?
Well, that's a definite possibility, and so there has to be a fairly strict control on how long something can remain in low orbit or what area of space it can be sent to. There really isn't much of a damage the danger of collision, because space is actually very, very large. But the longer something remains in orbit, then the more significant the probability of being struck by something is. I think that really we're going to have some sort of regulations enacted that prevent people from placing, trivial things or large quantities of dangerous things in orbit. And that's probably going to happen pretty quickly. There are a number of regulations in place right now that sort of restrict what you can send up.
How will we know as a government, as people, that some other company, you look back at the James Bond movies and the evil Spectra and what they would do. How do we know that that's not going to happen?
Well, there's an interesting point to this, and that is everything you do right now is pretty much observed. If you launch something, the launch signatures are being observed by satellites in orbit around the Earth now. Consider how we know whether a country has launched missiles at us or not. So there are systems observing the planet right now, and many countries have them, and they look for launch signatures. So if you throw something into space, it's going to leave a signature that's going to be seen, and they're going to know pretty fast that a rocket launch has occurred. On the other hand, if you did get something into space of a significant size, you also have radar tracking, and people are watching things in space right now. They track tens of thousands of items that are orbiting the Earth, and many of them are very small. You'll recall on a shuttle flight just a while back, they lost a couple of tools in orbit. And, hardware and tools can pose a real threat. Now, fortunately, in low Earth orbit, eventually those items will decay in their orbit due to the very, very thin atmospheric drag that occurs, and they will eventually end up re-entering and burning up. So, that is working in our favor. But if you've got something really large up there, they now have a type of materials, metamaterials, that can actually allow you to shield things from radar. So it would make it very difficult, if you were really dedicated to the task, to detect something that had been properly shielded. There are development programs right now that produce materials that are in the experimental stage that actually make radar more or less flow around an object so it can't be seen.
As we had a story a couple of weeks ago, Sir Charles, where the Chinese apparently had tested some kind of laser beam that they could use on satellites, and they would be able to pinpoint and direct a laser beam either to knock it out or do something with it. That's dangerous because our entire society now is based on satellite technology.
Well, yes, it is. And a lot of people are looking at alternatives to that. One of the things that has been suggested is if we use a massive fiber optic network on the ground, to a great degree, we could decrease our dependence on satellite communications. And this is already happening in a lot of ways through the growth of the Internet itself. So consider that even though our technology has just exploded in the last four decades, a lot of the radio noise that we would have expected to create normally is not there because we're using cable and fiber optic networks to send that data instead. So, it may be very well that in a few years we really won't depend on satellites so much for communication other than keeping track of objects and watching the weather.
Amazing. Well, stay with us. We're going to talk a little bit about some of these Mars images that you've sent us. And, of course, a number of other things as they direct relate to space and space flight. I'm George Norrie with our guest tonight, Sir Charles Schulz III on Coast to Coast AM. China's next Shenzhou spacecraft to launch astronauts into orbit is under construction, and officials are drawing up plans for the 2008 space shot. The country's state-run media is reporting that. The country's next crewed space flight, which will be Shenzhou 7, is slated to launch three astronauts spaceward, and include at least one spacewalk as China moves forward with plans to build an orbital space station. Sir Charles, is there a risk, a danger here, that China will match us or even surpass us with space technology?
Oh, it's quite possible. In fact, they're making a lot of advances right now, and they're gaining a lot of technical advantages that way. Because of the things required to make spaceflight a reality, and a safe one at that, And the ability to make a profit at it also depends on your ability to do it cheaply and safely. Because of these advances, they're going to pass a lot of the things that we've done in the past soon, and they're going to possibly match us in the very near future if they proceed as the way they are.
Is it because they're doing it so well, or are we lagging from moving ahead?
Well, you know, as far as it goes, we're lagging behind. We've lost a lot of the impetus, and only the real development is occurring in private industry right now, not in government. And it really is a fact that NASA has been more of a detriment to the development of private space flight, because who wants to compete with an organization that can, you know, come forward with billions of dollars on demand for a project? It's put a lot of small companies out of business, particularly those who had to wait for launches on NASA-run vehicles. So with the private space developments we're seeing today in our country, we're going to see a great deal of that turnaround shortly. And it's an unfortunate thing that we have to depend on, let's say, Russia to launch most of our hardware in the private sector right now. And pretty soon, some of that business could be going to China because of the developments they're making.
If you were given complete authority to set up either a governmental space program or a program that would fund the private sector, what would you do and how would you do it?
I think I would depend more on private sector growth, because you get far more ideas, and many of them are a little out of the box. Government thinking is sometimes rather restricted, even though you can get some really great talent because you have a lot of funding, you have deep pockets to work with. But, you know, the people who have the highest confidence in what they're doing and in their abilities, and the ones who have the biggest challenges in front of them, tend to produce very much, you know, everything that we have. If it were up to me, I would set up some sort of an office in the government to work with private companies to develop different aspects of the commercial space flight industry. I certainly wouldn't restrict it the way NASA and the government have at the present time.
Let's talk again about who some of the major players are in private space development. Of course, you mentioned Bigelow. We've got Virgin. He's doing very well building what he's doing. He's even building his spaceport. What other companies are involved here, Sir Charles?
Well, okay, you know, you mentioned Robert Bigelow, and he's one of the biggest players with his company, Bigelow Aerospace. Bert Rutan from Scaled Composites is one of the major figures in space development, and you can find him at scaled.com, and he has a long history of aeronautical innovations and has been one of the truly most significant contributors to aviation in years. As everyone probably knows, he and his efforts won the X Prize a couple of years ago, and he's produced a vehicle that can carry passengers for suborbital flights. And then he sold that technology to Sir Richard Branson, who's our next major figure in private space development. Now, Sir Richard is developing spacecraft from that technology, and he has Virgin Galactic, and that is a company that will offer $200,000 suborbital space flights to anybody who comes up with the money. And they will be flying, I believe, in less than 2 years, the way things are running. And he's basically mass-producing these vehicles. And, you know, let me point out that it would take just a very minor modification, and instead of carrying passengers, you could actually launch a small satellite from one of these things with a booster on it to place it in orbit. So that's just something for people to consider that might not have come to the table yet. Another player is Elon Musk, and SpaceX is his company. Now, this is interesting because Elon Musk started in electronic publishing, and he set up a company that became PayPal.
Okay.
And made many millions of dollars on
sure.
the Internet. And one of his projects was the Mars Oasis Project. He planned to land a greenhouse on Mars and use the soil to grow crops. And it came to a halt because of the exorbitant cost of launch. So he began to dedicate himself and his company that he started to bringing the cost of launch down, so that it would be far more reasonable so that he and other companies as well could be able to afford this sort of thing. And here's another interesting one, John Carmack of Armadillo Aerospace. Now, many people don't know, John Carmack is the fellow who wrote the game Doom, and everybody has played Doom. It's a very popular computer and video
right.
game, and there is even a movie made at one point. Well, John Carmack was a guy who wrote the game, and he made millions of dollars on it and founded Armadillo Aerospace, and they've made a very serious effort and built some very interesting flight hardware. Now, his company recently competed in the Lunar Lander Challenge that was held, and was just a hair's breadth away from actually winning. Basically, they had to launch a vehicle that under robotic control or automatic control would fly to a designated area, make a landing, pick up and come back again, and land at the original takeoff site. And it's a very interesting challenge, and it's a very technically difficult challenge, and they're very close to cracking it. And another person, Peter Diamandis, who is in the XPRIZE Foundation. He's the head of the XPRIZE Foundation, and he's also the co-founder of Zero Gravity Corporation. And that's a company that gives zero-gravity flights aboard aircraft that fly the parabolic paths. It simulates zero-G for the passengers. And he also created the Rocket Racing League, which we'll be seeing a lot of things in the news with very shortly. And he's the co-founder and director of Space Adventures Limited, and that's the company that's flown for space tourists, the International Space Station. So they're making money and they're doing business. John Powell from JP Aerospace, that's another competitor. He's working on a concept of airships to orbit. Basically, they're flying high-altitude balloon craft that take packages to the very edge of space. Then they're developing an airship to orbit craft so they'll be able to launch them into space from the top edge of the atmosphere, using literally a balloon to get you up there. Then there's Jeff Bezos from Blue Origin. Now, he's the founder of Amazon.com. And many people know that's where he made his billions. And so we see a lot of people who are entrepreneurs or mavericks, who some of them are internet billionaires, and they're putting their money into space. And people may wonder why. Well, it's the up-and-coming thing. We know that there's going to be life in space. People are going to be moving and working and commuting there.
Sure.
And so these people are investing because they see where the future is. Now, his company is developing a reusable liquid fuel propulsion system, and they're working toward a manned suborbital launch system that'll give you low-cost launch services. And then another one, David Mastin of Mastin Space Systems, they're putting together standard launch systems for payloads in 1-kilogram increments. So if you wanted to launch 2 or 5 or 7 kilograms, you could work out a very easy pay schedule and figure out what it's going to cost, and they'll launch it for you. And they're selling slots in their vehicles for something called CANSATs. You basically can put something up about the size of a soda can that weighs 350 grams, and they're working on basically flying anything you want, and they're working on larger packages as well, as long as, you know, not hazardous and not going to blow up their rocket. And then there are non-rocketry solutions to space travel. Michael Lane at Liftport, that's a space elevator company, they're developing the space elevator hardware that will go up and down a tether made of carbon fibers, and this tether will reach from orbit all the way to the ground. And then there's Bradley C. Edwards of Carbon Designs Incorporated. They have a high lift systems thing. They're at AmericanAntiGravity.com. They have a page there that you can see what they're doing. And basically, these are people who are building elevators that go all the way into space from the ground.
Oh, that concept is incredible, isn't it?
Well, yes, it is. And it can be a very serious competitor to space flight because it's so low in cost. And once it's set up, it could actually compete very favorably with a lot of transport systems, because you can carry something halfway up the tether and let it go, and it will ballistically proceed to the ground somewhere with a little guidance. You can develop stuff that'll go all over the world without the use of rockets. You go up in an elevator to some altitude, you kick the payload out, and it follows a path to the ground. Now, they could both run into some trouble in the near term because of the materials they're using. Composites are the issue here. You know, Boeing and other large aircraft companies are presently developing air bodies that will be completely made of composites rather than a magnesium or aluminum. And they want to do this because it's going to cut thousands of pounds off every aircraft they produce. Well, if they go ahead with the plan, then it's going to put a serious dent in the availability of carbon and composite materials over the next few years. Presently, aircraft and sporting goods are the largest use of carbon composites, as far as I've been able to determine. You know, golf clubs and bicycles and kayaks, all these things are made out of carbon composites now.
Exactly. Airplane brakes, right?
Exactly. And if Boeing or other large companies decides to use this material on the scale that they're planning, it would actually make this material unavailable to many other industries. So I would suggest, if they do go ahead with their plan, you might want to invest in that as a growth industry, because carbon composites are going to be a very important material. And so there could be an effect on the materials needed to build a space elevator, as well as other things.
You know, it's funny, Sir Charles, a dear friend of mine owns a carbon fiber company. He's one of the major stockholders now, but he formed the company, started it. It's now publicly held. I'm not going to give the name of the company because everybody will run on the stock. But he is building plants in Hungary. He's got a few there, but he's expanding. He's got plants here in the United States. And he claims that the demand for carbon fiber is going to be absolutely outrageous in the future, just like you say.
Well, it is. And people have to consider, you know, how industries and space travel are very tightly related. You know, many years ago, whenever there'd be a slowdown in the defense industry, people would think, well, it'll just shut down this defense plant. But really, it doesn't. because the materials that a defense company or an aerospace company happens to use are things like microchips and refined metals and specialty items, and those have to be produced by other companies. And so each of those companies has to have a staff of people to produce those materials, and they have to have the resources on hand to produce it. And there's a whole pyramid of industry that's behind the production of, let's say, a single missile or a single flight vehicle. So when you have a slowdown or an increase in the industry, it really has a huge effect on industry of our country as a whole. So growth in the space industries actually will have a very beneficial effect, even on things we wouldn't perceive as being directly related to it.
Explain the elevator concept, because I assume it'll be anchored, of course, to the planet. That'll be the base where the elevator starts and up the cables it goes. What the heck is it anchored to in space? How does it stay up there?
Well, actually, it's very simple. You can imagine a satellite that's in stationary orbit high above the Earth. If you were to go up, though, 22,300 miles above the equator and place a satellite in orbit, it would move at precisely the same rate that the Earth rotates. So it effectively would be stationary in the sky for us.
Right.
Now, suppose you made a cable from that satellite and you began extending it to the ground. As long as you extend the cable down to the ground and in the opposite direction you have a countermass that balances it, the satellite will still remain in its same place in orbit. Well, eventually, the one end of the cable could reach the ground. So the satellite, most of the mass, remains in orbit. That's what keeps it up.
Theoretically, if you tugged on the cable, could you begin to pull that satellite down?
Well, in theory, but you see, by putting a countermass at the far end, when you attach it to the ground, it's under tension.
Okay.
And so now you don't have to worry about it.
So the countermass...
That's right. It will counteract the force of weight hanging on the cable.
And how long would it take to travel up this elevator?
If you were going up at elevator speeds, a couple of hundred miles per hour or so, or a couple of hundred kilometers per hour, then you would expect to get up to the geostationary point in about 8 to 10 days. It really depends on how fast the system can travel up the cable safely.
Would that be a vehicle for travel for people? I mean, would groups of 10 or 20, I don't know how big the elevator would be, go up that way?
It could, but right now what we would be looking at is hauling cargo up to build more space elevators. And most of the time you would be using them simply for hauling materials up rather than down, because anything can come back down pretty easily using a standard reentry system. So, yes, in effect, you could have a system that actually could carry people up to geostationary orbit as passengers on, let's say, a 10-day cruise. And once they got there, they would have access to anything in space, because once you're there, you're halfway to anywhere in the universe.
Well, can you imagine if they built hotels and then they have these elevators attached to them? That brings back a whole new meaning to everything that hotels in this on the planet Earth have been doing.
Well, yes, it does. And you know, one of the strategies, incidentally, to anchoring the cable, the other end of the space elevator, to the ground, is actually to have a floating platform at sea. And this would mean you wouldn't infringe on anybody's territory, or you wouldn't depend on having to find land right on the equator. There's
right,
not a whole lot of land on the Earth that is on the equator that we'd have easy access to. So an ocean-going platform would be probably the best solution to that.
Well, and as big as this planet is, there is that possibility that a plane might clip into the cable, isn't there?
Well, the possibility is there, but you'd have to have a no-fly zone instituted, as we do for many things
on
the ground already. So that wouldn't really be much of a difficulty.
How many elevators one day, let's look 100 years into the future, assuming this is a great way to get up there, how many elevators might we have on this planet?
Well, there could be dozens or hundreds eventually if it turns out that that's the cheapest way to go. Understand that economics is generally the thing that will drive this, and, of course, the laws of physics. But, you know, in 100 years, we may have something radically different. We may figure out how to manipulate gravity at that point, you know, and I wouldn't put it past people. And at that point, it probably wouldn't make a lot of sense to have a space elevator. But until that day, or until that capability is available, the space elevator is a very sensible way to go if we can make it work. And there are still some unresolved questions, but I do believe, you know, I feel very optimistic about it.
Some of the players that you mentioned in private space travel, some of them are characters. I mean, Richard Branson is a character. I remember watching him when Stephen Fawcett in Branson's plane went around the world nonstop. I mean, he loves life. He's excitable. I like the guy. He kind of reminds me of a Donald Trump, almost like a take charge person. Who is the spearhead right now for private space? Is it Branson, Bigelow? Who's out there? Who's really number one?
Definitely both of them are right at the top of the list. And you have to consider for a moment that this isn't something that a timid individual does. When you're investing hundreds of millions or billions of dollars of your own money in a venture, you have to know at the outset that the person who's willing to do that has to be a firecracker. You know, you're not an individual that's going to sit at home on the couch.
There's no return right now.
Well, yes, and it only stands to reason, because if you have the drive and initiative to get out there and make $1 billion, you're not the type of person who sits at home anyway. You're going to go and look for the most exciting things to do and the most interesting things to do. And simultaneously, you're going to temper that with common sense, because you're not going to simply throw your money away.
And I think part of their mission isn't necessarily to make more money, because they've already done that. I think it's the challenge to do something interesting and fascinating.
Well, absolutely. You know, each of us has an opportunity to contribute something to the world we live in. And if we can just make it a little nicer or better place just because we've lived here, then that's a wonderful thing. And people who are particularly very wealthy have great opportunities to help improve how we live and how the world is. And so when they actually go forth and do that, it's a very inspiring thing.
Well, it sure is. Next hour, Charles, let's talk about Mars and some of those anomalies there with some of the images that you have sent us. As we talk about, again, the privatization of space, I agree with you. I think it's the way to go. We should have done it 20 years ago.
Well, yes, absolutely, we should have.
But we did not. We did not. How about other countries that have been in space? You know, the Europeans, they have their union. Are they looking toward privatization? I mean, Branson is from the United Kingdom, but are there other countries that are going private, or are they still governmental?
Well, a lot of it is governmental, and, you know, the regulations there are quite different. But there are companies that are operating offshore from the United States and in other countries, and they've gotten actually some very favorable tax breaks and conditions on, you know, for their work. There are companies that have actually set up spaceports and research centers outside our country because the regulations are less stringent. It really depends on where you go and who you're associated with. Right now, the regulations in our country are very restrictive in many ways, although there have been some very positive changes made in the last few years.
Stick with us with our special guest, Sir Charles Schulz III. Henry, by the way, from Hawaii, writes, simply fast blast me and said, George, we're going to need some really good elevator music if we're going to send people all the way to the top floor of a space hotel. So true, Henry, so true. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. I'm in for Art Bell tonight. I'll probably have Art fill in for me on Friday. Art had some technical problems in the Philippines, so I am here for you. Now we'll be back in a moment with Sir Charles Schulz III. Get up to the coasttocoastam.com website. Take a look at the Mars images he has sent us. We're going to talk about that in a moment, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Well, so Charles, I know you went through this with Art when you first came on the program some time ago, but tell me how your interest in Mars and some of these anomalies came about.
Well, I've always been fascinated by Mars because, as some people know, it's the most similar planet to Earth in our solar system, and it has an interesting history as well. People have long believed that there might have been life on Mars, and it's always been an interesting place because it's not that far away from us, and it's very much like the Earth. And so just in the course of study, working in the weapons and aerospace field, there are a lot of things you learn by studying other worlds and the physics involved in spaceflight that can teach you a lot about the systems you're working on. So it was just a natural outgrowth of my interest in spaceflight in general and seeing if there was life in the universe. It was a very interesting question.
What were some of these objects that you started to see originally that kind of perked your interest?
Well, the one that really caught my attention was when they released the first picture of all the little spherules, the blueberries, as they called them. And I noticed that the image that NASA released had very poor contrast. If you downloaded the images themselves from the NASA site, they actually were quite sharp. And after looking them over, I discovered that many of these spherules, or blueberries, are actually the fossilized remains of very primitive aquatic organisms. And it turns out that Mars was indeed covered by an ocean. So We found seashells, sea urchins, and trilobite fossils. And after that, the findings came very rapidly. And I also have to make a nod to Richard Hoagland on one thing. You know, I heard that he was a little unhappy that I hadn't given some acknowledgement to the discovery of the crinoid early on in the opportunity images.
Ah, okay.
And, you know, I didn't, he and I work independently. We don't have any connection whatsoever. And so
Right. Anything
that we study happens to be, you know, just out of the can, whatever we find on the NASA site. And it's quite possible that he found the crinoid and published it first. It wouldn't surprise me in the least, because most of my efforts had been dedicated to the urchins and the coral and the other things earlier on. So, you know, in all fairness, I have to admit it's quite possible that he found that crinoid before I did.
Well,
we've got a wonderful crinoid from Spirit on Sol 343 on my site as well.
What's fascinating is you share similar views on some of these anomalies on Mars, and I find that fascinating. You being a scientist, and Richard, of course, being a researcher, that eventually I think you guys are going to mesh in terms of theoretical approach to what could be on Mars.
Well, understand that I have a completely different viewpoint about intelligence on Mars. I see very strong supporting evidence for oceans not too different from what our world's oceans were like many millennia ago. We definitely have aquatic fossils everywhere, and NASA has recently admitted that, yes, Mars was indeed covered by oceans. And it's interesting, because you would think that that would have gotten some major news or press coverage. But they really, you know, they said it, but they kept it very low key. So people really aren't aware of the fact that Mars was a water world, very much like our own. What's interesting is that Mars remains wet today. The water didn't simply vanish. A great deal of it is locked up as permafrost or glaciers, but there's also quite a bit of it in the soil still in liquid form, in the form of brine, because of all the salts that are present. If anybody looks at the water features on my pages, you'll see that there are many things that show the flow of water has created them. And in one case, you can see where one of the instruments of the rover, the Mossbauer spectrometer, was pressed against the sand and it leaves a circle. Some people have mistaken it for something that looks like a CD. In one particular case, on Sol 126, you can see the Mossbauer head has mud stuck to it, and you can see where it peeled out of the ground and the mud actually bulged when the Mossbauer was pressed up against it. And so it's very clear that the soil is wet now. It's not, you know, dusty and dry as people claim.
If you ever have time, get up to Richard's website, enterprisemission.com, Sir Charles. He's got a new picture up there of what he calls a robotic head, and it is amazing. I saw it at a conference a few weeks ago in Joshua Tree, California, and I got to tell you, this thing is uncanny. I mean, it looks like the head of a robot on the surface of Mars, picture taken by the Apollo 17 astronauts.
Well,
and it is,
right?
On the moon, rather, yes.
Yeah.
And it has got to be one of the most bizarre pictures I've ever seen.
Well, you know, it's easy to find very interesting-looking things. It wouldn't surprise me that we could find a number of things that look like anything we can imagine. The trick is to find many, many representative copies of something before you can say, yeah, that's very likely what you think it is. If you find one artifact or one item that appears to be something, it's very possible that it could simply be a trick of light and shadow. It's only really easy to confirm if you have multiple shots from many angles. You can assemble three-dimensional views. So you have some means of confirming that the dimensionality of the object matches what you think it is. In the case of the fossils, we literally have hundreds of fossils that you can look at and see features that are, you know, impossible to create through mineral means, such as 5- and 10-fold remote rotational symmetries. Crystals don't grow in fives. They grow in 2s, 3s, 4s, and 6s. And so little things like that stand out when you find the fossils. They have features that you won't find in minerals.
Well, with this planet then, Mars, being so laden with these fossils, why in God's name won't NASA make an announcement?
Well, you know, I've had a number of thoughts about that. Some people claim that the Brookings Institute report, you know, the claim that you shouldn't reveal the discovery of alien life to people because it'll cause like a religious uproar or changes in society. And perhaps, although I think that, you know, people are a little more sophisticated than that. You know, half of every movie we see is about aliens in space, and people accept it very easily. I think a more a more practical answer to that question would be, you know, NASA has about $15 billion a year roughly in funding. And when you do something like this, it pulls the rug out from under many of the planned missions and the instruments that they're going to send, and it could take 5 to 10 years for that to settle down. So we could be talking about, you know, $75 to $150 billion being influenced over the next decade by these findings. And I can see where it would cause a great deal of controversy and a lot of upset. Think of the people who built their careers on the research they've done and the proclamations they've made about their findings and how a lot of that would be disproven.
So you're also saying then that we may have plans, spacecraft, design that probably don't even have the capabilities as they go look for life. We already know, let's say, there's life on Mars. It throws them right out the window.
Well, yes, and consider the following. They've often billed this, the Mir or the rover mission, as the fall of the water. Yet neither of the rovers has any sensor for water whatsoever. Neither rover can detect liquid water. Neither rover can detect humidity or moisture in the soil. So neither one of the rovers has the ability to actually detect water, even though they're on a follow-the-water mission. But even more interesting, neither rover has the ability to identify any organic compound whatsoever. Neither one of them can identify a single molecule of anything organic. They can't determine whether it's inorganic or organic. And furthermore, there has been a claim for the last 30 years now, dating back to the work that Dr. Gil Levin did on Viking, looking for bacterial action in the soil.
Right.
There has been a claim for over 30 years now that it was simply peroxides, active chemicals in the soil. Well, the interesting thing about that claim is this. If peroxides were present in the soil, they would destroy magnetic iron oxide and make it non-magnetic. Yet there's magnetic dust sticking to trap magnets on the rovers. So that's the first sign of evidence that there are no peroxides in the soil. And another thing to consider is this. The rovers are made of some metals such as aluminum and magnesium that appear in the rovers that would be subject to corrosion if subjected to corrosion-inducing compounds such as peroxides. And we don't see evidence of that. So they could have easily settled these three questions, and they didn't.
These fossils on Mars, they look very similar to fossils on this planet. Have you uncovered anything that is bizarre in terms of appearance?
Well, not that I can actually put my finger on. There are some odd-looking things that may or may not be fossils, but the one thing to realize is that something truly bizarre we might not recognize. You would probably have to actually be there and do a hands-on analysis. We're going to recognize the things that most closely match what we have experience with. So if you see something truly bizarre, you might simply dismiss it as an odd configuration of light and shadow or a strange rock. When we see things that we do recognize, then it's very easy, if you find numerous copies of that, to verify that it is what you think it is.
So, Charles, what do you think happened to the planet?
Actually, it's very simple. Mars is a very small planet. It only has 38% of the surface gravity that our world does. And as a result, its atmosphere was lost simply because of its weak gravity. And as the atmosphere was lost to space, the water was broken down. Sunlight has a lot of ultraviolet in it, and it splits water molecules into hydrogen and oxygen. So the hydrogen blows off to space, and the oxygen reacts with materials on the ground. So basically, those are two of the factors right there. The other thing that's really interesting is Mars' axis is tilted very differently from the Earth's. Our axis is at 23.5 degrees, and it slowly changes over the years as we're orbiting the sun. Mars' axis actually is in a sort of a tumble, and it goes through almost vertical to quite a bit more inclined than our own planet. It's like a top wobbling as it spins. And so its climate can change dramatically in the space of 10 to 50,000 years. When this happens, when its pole aims closer to a low angle, more of the polar caps evaporate and the atmospheric pressure increases greatly. Some of the ice in the poles is dry ice, carbon dioxide, and the atmospheric pressure can actually triple over what we observe today, which means that large pools of water could be very, very prevalent on the planet then. The greenhouse effect will heat the planet up slightly, the atmospheric pressure will go up, and you'll see water return. Right now we know there's a whole sea of frozen glaciers on the equator of the planet.
How high up on the species list do you think animal life or insect life, fish life might have evolved on Mars?
Well, understand that the environment there would be very difficult. And so we can't expect that anything that we would expect running around the land would probably be common. On the other hand, we have found shark's teeth, and that indicates that bony fish did exist in the ocean, and that's fairly sophisticated. We've also found a couple of what appears to be squid fossils, and squid are not, you know, rocket scientists or anything. They're not real intelligent creatures. But on the other hand, they are rather sophisticated. So even though they would have appeared early on in the evolutionary scale, the presence of squid and shark indicates that there were things capable of perceiving and sensing and acting on their environment.
The planet's about 4.5 billion years old, like Earth. When do you think it lost its atmosphere?
Well, it's been losing it all along. The Earth is doing this as well. The difference is, the Earth has a much larger mass and a stronger gravitational field, and so we hold on to our atmosphere much more readily. Mars, being as small as it is, lost its atmosphere very easily. And there's another factor. The Earth has a very large core, a molten core, and it's outgassing materials from the core and the mantle all the time. So most of what comes out of a volcano, contrary to what people may think, is water vapor. So when you see all those clouds of smoke and steam coming out of a volcanic vent, that's the water vapor and the gas that replenishes our atmosphere. And on Mars, it has a very small core, and it cooled off early on, and its volcanism probably ceased a long time ago, so it didn't have the ability to replenish its atmosphere as our planet does.
Our planet is almost like a processing plant. It's amazing. Whatever this design was, Sir Charles, it works. But they all fit like a piece, like puzzles in a huge picture.
Well, that's true, but understand that every organism will evolve to fit its niche, and it's going to take advantage of what is available. So regardless of what planet an organism lives on, the organisms are going to be shaped by their environment so they can most easily survive there. And, you know, we're going to expect to find bacterial life on almost any planet that can support it, and probably more advanced life where the environment can remain watery and stable for an extended period of time.
So you don't believe the possibilities that we may be the Martians, that we have come from that planet somehow?
No, I don't at all. In fact, I think that once we get to Mars and take biological samples, we'll discover that the genetics and chemistry of the life there will be radically different from what we have here. And, you know, it'll be carbon-based life that uses water, clearly, but the genetic code and the compounds that they use will probably be very different. But on the plus side of that, we can expect that there will be many novel, useful medical compounds that can come out of the study of alien organisms.
If we find life on Mars, what do you think it will be like?
I would say any present-day life on Mars is more likely to be bacterial or fungal, but it's quite possible there could be some more advanced organisms similar to brine shrimp that can survive long periods of drought or freezing, and then when the environment becomes more clement, they might be able to emerge. We also might be able to find something in underground structures such as caverns where the presence of liquid water and a thicker atmosphere would be far more common.
You think at one time the planet had vegetation?
Well, there's no doubt. Any sort of a biosphere requires plants and animals. Most of your plant life does the basic energy fixing for any ecosystem. It captures the sunlight and the chemistry around it and uses it to produce biological matter. And in doing so, produces the materials that animal life needs to stay alive. So we can certainly expect to find plant life. In fact, I have some images from Sol 30 opportunity that show what appears to be fossilized leaves.
Oh, that is amazing. Well, we're going to get into some of these other images that you sent us, 3D images. I wish I had one of those little 3D glasses to be able to take a look at that. Would that help?
Yes, it would. If you've got the anaglyph glasses, as they're called, some people simply call them goofy glasses. They have the red lens over the left eye and the blue lens over the right eye. You'll find that you'll be able to see those images in 3D, and there are also many other anaglyphs on my site as well, and we're adding all the time.
All right, we'll talk about those pictures, Sir Charles, when we get back. What's new on your website? Fill us in.
Well, we've got a couple of things going on. Of course, we've got some energy projects we're working on, and we've got a solar generator we're building, and some of the details are there. Basically, it's a means of capturing sunlight and using it to run a steam generator and a turbine from there to produce electrical power.
Could we use that for our house?
Well, yes, you could. Right now, the models are small. I am doing some negotiating with some people in Mexico about providing possible power. And we're going to see if we can set up some sort of a manufacturing facility so they can produce them as compact power generators for people who live in areas where it isn't practical to run power lines. And another project we're working on is the Fly Your Card in Space project, which is basically send us your business card, and for a small sum we'll fly it either suborbital or orbital on vehicles that we're developing at our company.
Okay, so much like we were talking about, what are some of the objects people will send up there? Business
cards. Well, for the
cards,
most part, yes. Photographs, business cards, small things.
That's it. Now, how much would something like that cost?
We're looking at flying a card, fly your basic business card for $20 for an orbital flight and $10 for a suborbital flight.
That's it?
That's it.
And off my card goes. I may give you one of my coast-to-coast cards and get it up.
Okay, you'll find a link right on the top of my site on the homepage. We'll show you how to do it.
Now, if I get a phone call from somebody out there in space, though, that'll really be a story.
Who knows what business opportunities it would lead to.
I love it. That's a great, that's a novel idea. It really is. I'd like to talk with you a little bit, too, about your solar energy idea. Is it okay, it's not that proprietary where you can talk about it?
Well, there's quite a bit of information I can share. I wouldn't give a great deal of the details that could affect how we're implementing it, but I'll tell you quite a bit about it.
You're not going to send us the schematic of this apparatus?
No, I wouldn't do that.
How long have you been working on this?
Well, for a couple of years. There have been some other projects I've worked on and off over the years, and this is sort of a culmination of many different things coming together. It essentially is just the ability to grab a large quantity of sunlight, focus it down on a boiler, and generate steam power to run your generator.
I think that's fantastic. Any kind of alternative energy that we can come up with, Sir Charles, is, I think it's critical. We've got to start getting away from our reliance on oil. And more importantly, I think the grid's going to collapse one day. And if you at least had your own power structure for your home, at least you could keep things going for a while.
Well, yes, you could. And, you know, there's nothing that prevents you from adding other components to a solar-powered system, such as a wind generator or any other thing you can think of. If you have more than one option for producing your power and you funnel it into one common system so it's all compatible, then basically you're not going to be without power at any time.
I had a call that somebody had developed a generator that they were going to market through one of the large hardware home stores, and we called the hardware home store, and they didn't know anything about it. But it was like a perpetual motion machine that ran from water.
Well, we're not working on anything as exotic as that. We're sticking down with the hard, grounded physics.
All right, we'll be back in a moment with Sir Charles Schultz III on Coast to Coast AM. Well, the audiobook version of our book, Worker in the Light, is available on Amazon.com. And then the book itself is available also on Amazon.com and the major bookstores. And I hope you particularly like the chapter that I addressed about our Ouija board story. It's called Worker in the Light. Back in a moment with Sir Charles Schultz on Coast to Coast AM. Sir Charles, let's take a look at some of the images that you've provided us here and let you explain them to us. Those of us without the luxury of having the 3D glasses, help us out a little bit here as well.
Okay, the top image shows a seashell that was located on Sol 913 in Gusev by Spirit, and the rover is wintering there, so they've placed it on the side of a hill where the solar panels can still gather enough sunlight to operate the rover. And, of course, while they're there, they've done extensive imaging of the area all around the rover, and we found, five or six good seashells, and that's one of the very clearest. It shows a spiral shell that's broken open, and the point of the spiral is aimed directly at the camera. So with the anaglyph glasses, you can see that it's a very thin wall structure. It's uniform and curved, exactly like a seashell. And, you know, normally if you saw one item of this sort, you'd dismiss it as perhaps, you know, a volcanic rock or just a fluke. But we've got many others that are very similar in the area. On the Sol 913 images and the Sol 925 images, you can see two different styles of seashell, both in anaglyphs. And all of them are available in 3D. And the important thing about the 3D images is many things you see in a flat picture may or may not be what you think they are. When you get the images in three dimensions, you can tell the actual shape and that it's not simply a trick of light and shadow. So it's very important to be able to see them in 3D, and the anaglyphs provide a very easy way for people to do that. The lower image shows what is basically the flow of mud in a crater, and we know that above in Meridiani, where Endurance Crater is, there is a large geyser field which was imaged on Sol 114 that shows a huge amount of activity. This is one of those areas where water has flowed and carried the sand and mud. And you can see in the 3D view that it's terraced, exactly like you would find on Earth. The mud is in layers as the water has flowed. And you can see flow lines above and below that flow that are very clear. And in other words, Mars is wet now, and these geysers have been operating. And some of them, understand, are very low pressure. They're not spraying a lot of water sometimes. They're more like a sand boil. And anybody who's been near a natural spring knows that sometimes water will erupt under low pressure from the ground and create an area where the sand is boiling in that water. And so a sand boil is probably the best approximation of what many of these geysers operate like on Mars.
It's unfortunate we can't see any vegetation on this photograph, this image.
Well, almost all of your vegetation, if not all at this point, would probably be dead. I don't expect we're going to find any living vegetation on Mars right now unless it's something we just don't recognize or it lives under the soil.
Right.
Because of the harsh conditions, any plant life would probably take refuge under the soil where just enough sunlight gets through to keep it going. But an interesting thing is there are some plants on Earth, particularly primitive organisms, that produce their own natural sun blocker. So it isn't unheard of. And again, you know, many plants on Earth are green and some are purple. It may be that a different pigment is used in the Martian ecology. So it could be orange and match the background. And we have a lot of lichens and plants on Earth that are yellow and orange that, if seen on Mars, would be indistinguishable from the background rocks.
Of this mudflow image, in terms of distance from the rover, what would you guess that might be?
I would say about a meter and a half from the rover.
That's a pretty close picture then.
Oh, yes, it's quite close. There are a whole compendium of pictures that they put together in the press release images that show where the rover was parked for a number of sols or Martian days, and they have assembled all of the images that were taken by it in all directions into one large panoramic view and also an overhead view. So I'm going to be placing a page up very shortly that has many of the geysers on an active page. So as you move your cursor over the image, you'll be able to click each of the features and see some great details, including 3D images of them. And, you know, it's amazing how much water has to be erupting from underground there. Now, the interesting thing is Victoria Crater shows similar action. And there's one thing that you see that clues you in that something is emerging from under the rocks and it can't be an artifact of the wind. And that is, these rock slabs, which are broken into large polygons, as many people have seen, are often buried by the sand that blows over them. Well, some of them show that the edges of the rocks are blown clear. Now, you know that wind can't come out and, like with a fingertip, scrape the sand away around the outline of the rock. So something is emerging from underneath the slabs of rock, and it's blowing the sand away there. And obviously, the solution would be a liquid such as water. And since we see that the soil is cohesive and bulges just like mud when you press it, and it also sticks to things, then we have to conclude that there's liquid water. Because liquid carbon dioxide, for instance, which has been proposed by some people, doesn't work that way.
You think there could be some areas there, Sir Charles, that could be like quicksand?
Well, it's quite possible. And, you know, the interesting thing is, with many of the recent pictures over the last couple of years from Mars images from Malin Space Science Systems, for instance, we're seeing what appears to be weeping at the edges of craters and rills. And apparently there's quite a deal of sand covering ice, ice in the soil such as glaciers or permafrost. And when it melts, it wets the sand. You'll see what look like dark streaks coming down out of the sand, and then over time they fade away. Now, the official position is these are dust slides, but dust doesn't change color just because it slid down a hill, nor does it get lighter again when it's done sliding. And the other question is, if these are dust slides, where did the dust go? Because there's no sign of it at the bottom of the slide. It's pretty clear that this is liquid water erupting from under the surface, and in some cases producing what appears to be exceptionally salty or hypersaline brine lakes that last for a short while on the surface. There's some very good images from the European Space Agency showing these.
Of all the photographs that you've looked at and images over the last 2 years, what baffles you the most? What shocks you the most? What compels you the most? Is there one?
You know, I would not really be able to say what baffles me the most, other than the absolute refusal by our official space agency to recognize or announce what's been found. On Mars itself, I don't know, it's an amazing planet. But I don't see anything that, you know, violates the laws of physics or is just totally outlandish. You figure that wherever life develops, it's going to follow the same rules of chemistry and physics as it does right here at home. And so we're going to see some very similar organisms in many cases. So I wouldn't really say anything really baffles me, but something that intrigues me a lot is the areas that appear to be lakes. I would just love to be able to get down and have a close look at some of those areas.
If you were with some experts with NASA, How would you convince them, Sir Charles, that what we're looking at would be indeed fossils?
Well, I've got a number of images that show what's known as five-fold rotational symmetry or pentagonal symmetry. If you look at some of the markings on the spherules that are repetitive on many of them, and many of them show such features as clefts that repeat on many of them. Many of them are trilobites. They have ridges. Some look exactly like shrimp. It wouldn't probably take me more than 10 minutes to convince them if they would sit down and talk to me. Of course, at this point, really none of them have responded to any of the material I've sent them, and none of them have bothered to answer. And, you know, it wouldn't take long to confirm or dismiss what I found. It would be very, very easy to do, and I'm always open to any approach that they have.
Other than Richard C. Hoagland, who would agree with you on a lot of these artifacts, is anybody else coming forward saying, you know, Sir Charles, I agree with you. I think there's something there.
Well, a number of people have, and some of them actually work for Jet Propulsion Lab and NASA, but they've all requested that I don't really reveal their identities, and some haven't told me who they are. I've only been able to confirm, you know, where their communications came from. And they do agree, but understand that they have signed non-disclosure agreements that prevent them from saying anything officially or publicly. And, you know, there's a possibility that they could face prosecution if they violate that non-disclosure agreement. So, and many of them depend on funding from, you know, for their research or education from NASA or the government or other similar agencies, and so it would basically be professional suicide because they would lose funding and, you know, credibility and a lot of their academic work.
You know, I would think, Sir Charles, that NASA would be jumping for joy that they found life on another planet. But you're right. They're just not excited about this.
Well, it's interesting because in some of the historical documents you read on Project Viking, they did a test where they placed a trilobite in the field of view of one of the cameras. And when the image came up, one of the fellows says, hey, that's a trilobite. And the other fellows talked to him and said, no, no, that can't be, and actually convinced him that it wasn't. Well, when they actually saw the hardware itself, you know, the rock itself, they saw that it was a trilobite. They had a mock press conference, and they announced, well, it looks like we found life on Mars. And they were extremely humorless about it. They got quite upset that they even joked about it. Now, in recent times, when they were testing the rovers, they used some of them in test areas like the Petrified Forest. And so the geologists are driving the rovers around, and the fellows that set the experiment up are sitting back waiting. And never did any of the geologists say, hey, that looks like petrified wood. They simply refused to identify what they were seeing. And that was right here on the ground during testing.
If we're paying for these missions and we're not being told what they're finding, that's criminal.
Well, yes, but, you know, there's one excellent thing that's come out of this, and that's all the information that they've published on the web. Anyone can look at anything I've published on my site, and they can go directly to the original data and confirm for themselves that it is in the original images. Now, that doesn't mean we've gotten everything released, and in some cases I've seen that they have held back images for 7 months or nearly a year, and then later release them. And then on further observation, you know, the images, you don't really see anything outstanding. So why they would do that, I don't know. But, you know, it's quite possible there are a number of images they haven't released. We'll never know until it actually happens.
Do you believe if we had private space travel, let's say to Mars, and there was a private company that did its own rovers, do you believe they would disclose if they found fossil life, past life?
I have no doubt that they would because, you know, they paid the money to get there, and they stand to gain the most by making such a discovery. I have no doubts that they would clearly announce what they discovered, unless they had, you know, some hidden reason not to. There are a number of people who have specific beliefs that they simply don't want violated. Somehow it seems to, I don't know, pull the rug out from under their world. So I would think that anybody who'd done that sort of research on their own would definitely want to announce what they found. And they'd have a very real claim for that sort of information.
How close are we to having private companies do what we just said?
I would say that within five years, we could probably see a private company launch something to Mars. But the only danger that we face there is if they bring a sample back, we could bring back organisms that would be, you know, dangerous to our planet. So, you know, space,
the Andromeda
private industry in space, yeah, is a very positive thing, but it also comes with its dangers that we have to be quite careful about. And, you know, on the private space front, you know, if anybody feels the need to develop their own hardware, there's a standard called the CubeSat standard, which is available online, and they can actually purchase a kit to to build their own satellite that fits a standard that has been preconceived and laid out and is accepted by most everybody. And, you know, if you build your own CubeSat, you can find a launcher for it. So, you know, you can do it.
So what's it cost to build one?
Well, I don't know exactly what the costs are. It's really going to depend on what you send up. But, you know, the standard kit, if you start with one of the kits, you can do your development from 9 to 24 months is what they figure. From the time you conceive the type of satellite you want to the time you have it finished could be as little as 9 months.
Gosh, I thought it was tough when I was a kid to build radios. Now you're building satellites, huh? That's amazing.
Well, it's already been done by hobbyist groups. You know, I remember there was a Boy Scout group that put a satellite together that had a ham radio repeater in it, and they got it launched as ballast, and it actually flew.
I love it. Let's take a few minutes to talk about the solar energy projects that you had mentioned, the solar generator. Your solar panels, are they changing? Do they get better, more sensitive?
Well, they do, but the solar panels we use are not based on solar cells like photovoltaics. We're taking a completely different route. We've got a system that allows us to use many Fresnel lenses to gather and concentrate the sunlight and then direct it to one boiler for our generator. So we can make the thing just as expandable as we wish, and the individual elements track the sun so that you get really good exposure over the course of the day. So what we're doing is radically different. You know, with a solar panel that's available now, you generally get about 20 to 21% maximum efficiency, converting your sunlight into electricity. With the system we're using, you could theoretically get 60% or better.
That's amazing. It really is.
Well, you know, sunlight is basically free, and on the days that it would produce the most energy, those are the days when you'd need the most for your air conditioning. So it fits hand in glove with your requirements. If you place a system like this on your roof, it's absorbing the sunlight and preventing a lot of the heat from heating your home. So your air conditioning costs go down right there. And then if you're using it to run your air conditioning, you use a grid interconnect, and you can actually sell your excess power back to the power company and make a profit.
Absolutely, and I've always believed that we should be able to go in this direction, and that government should give us a 100% tax write-off for anybody who goes ahead and purchases one of these units or a unit like this.
Well, that sounds very good. It's just that we have to stop and consider where that money would actually be coming from. And, you know, it comes out of our pockets in the first place. You know, maybe that's a good idea, maybe not. Subsidies are fine. You know, we don't want to absolutely destroy a subsidy, but making 100% might be just impractical. Even a 50% subsidy, however, would make many of these systems well within reach of every man.
How long for you do you think before this could get to a market?
Well, I expect to have some really decent working hardware in about 3 months here. We've done tests on each of the individual segments. We've got some in-house built turbines that work quite nicely on even very low pressure. We've got boilers that work well enough, and we've got solar collectors, generally very large Fresnel lenses that work very well. And in some cases, we've had the lenses hit thousands of degrees. We've got furnaces here based on Fresnel lenses that can literally convert stone into lava in seconds. And so we've had a very interesting and fun time working on these systems. I'd say in a few months we're going to have a system ready to go.
That's exciting. Those of us, by the way, listening to us on KEX, the Monster out of Portland, do fast blast me if you felt a rumble or two. You just got hit in Portland, right around the urban area there, with a 2.6 magnitude earthquake. Not particularly huge, but I'm told some houses and buildings swayed just a little bit. So do that. Send me a fast blast, those of you in the Portland area, if you felt or got a little jolt from this 2.6 magnitude earthquake. Do you think Mars is active with earthquakes, Sir Charles?
Oh, yes. I'm sure there's still some activity underground. You know, I don't think a planet ever completely cools off inside. And as it cools, it shifts and shrinks and cracks, and so there's bound to be some quaking here and there. There's another interesting factor that a lot of people don't consider. When a planet turns on its axis, the tidal forces it is subjected to change over the whole, you know, stretch of the globe. And so the planet is going to flex slightly. So we should expect that there's going to be some sort of geological activity from time to time, even if the volcanism is completely gone.
Well, that's fascinating. Quick question about the ISS, the International Space Station. Do you see that as being worthwhile?
You know, it's a sad thing, but I don't. It was designed with the best of intent, and essentially the way it worked out, it's really kind of useless. They are doing some research there, but it's mostly medical research that could have been done far more cheaply on smaller vehicles. It seems they spend 60 to 70% of their time just staying alive. And at the cost of $100 billion and growing, I don't even see the possibility that it's going to be finished before the shuttle is taken out of service. And when you consider, you know, what Robert Bigelow launched for $75 million, his station is about a third of the length of the ISS. And when he goes to launching his larger modules, he will easily be able to put a system up far larger than the International Space Station for well under $1 billion.
Oh, my God. I mean, is this government waste at work? Is that what's going on here?
Well, understand that NASA isn't about innovation anymore. It's about control, unfortunately. And so I think that we're going to see NASA pretty much wither and die within the next 20 years or so. And actually, it would be a very good thing. And understand that NASA is not a public space agency, as many people envision it. It's really a portion of the Department of Defense. So there are a lot of reasons for why they do things the way they do, and many of them might be a little inscrutable and unknown to us.
Well, that's so true. And though it may not wither away, it may do so publicly, I think it'll always have that military application, don't you?
Well, yes, it will. And that's one of the reasons we've seen many military missions flown on the shuttle, not just the shuttle's launch capacity, because understand there are large vehicles that could easily be put into service that could do larger launches than the shuttle. And, in fact, Gene Myers of Space Island Group is working on a replacement for the shuttle, and he and I have had an association for a couple of years, and he recently got a couple of $1 billion in funding for his ventures. And, you know, he's been communicated with by Mike Griffin of NASA, and yeah. It was related to him that, you know, he could do a really wonderful, cheap, and fast job. And, well, you know, I can't relate everything he said, but basically it was very encouraging, and I expect that Gene's going to have some flight hardware up there pretty soon, too.
That's exciting. Stay with us. We're going to come right back with Sir Charles Schulz. We'll take your phone calls about some of the things we've been talking about tonight. So get ready to go. And if you have those 3D images, get up to the images that he gave us on the coasttocoastam.com website. Sir Charles, how would you compare the joint European space program with ours?
Well, actually, it compares pretty favorably. They've got a lot of different players in the field, and so they get technology from many different countries and viewpoints involved. And in fact, I think in many ways they're ahead of us in some of the sensing and the data they're sending back. On the other hand, they have the same sort of censorship for some of the material that we experience over here. And anybody who heard about Formosano, Vittorio Formosano's findings of methane and ammonia and formaldehyde in the Martian atmosphere knows how that went. He was pretty much silenced and was only allowed to speak about the methane findings, nothing about the ammonia or the formaldehyde.
All right, we go to phones this hour. We'll pick it up by going east to the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Yes, hello.
Yeah.
Claire in Indianapolis. Sir Charles, I would like to know if we're talking about genetics and all that. I think there's a correlation between evolution and genetic memory.
Well, yes, okay. So what's your question, basically?
Well, I guess my question is there a correlation between evolution and genetic memory?
Well, I think, first of all, we have to define what you mean by genetic memory. Some people feel that memories can be transmitted from one organism to the other using genetics. In fact, when you look at it, the only thing that gets transmitted is perhaps the wiring of a brain, and I wouldn't really call that a memory, but maybe a tendency or a talent or an ability. Genetics, of course, determines everything that you become, and then your learning and your environment polishes it off. I don't think there's really much debate about the fact that what you are is mainly determined by your genetics. And as things evolve, their genetics change to match the environment. Genetics is more or less the message that controls what your body becomes and what you're capable of doing.
But then how does that happen?
Well, it's because every piece of information in your genes is an instruction for the construction of either a protein or an enzyme. And when these materials are constructed according to those blueprints, they result in the structure of an organism. And it's a very complex thing, and some of the genes actually act as control boxes, very much like subroutines in software.
Amazing. Totally amazing. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Claire. Appreciate you being on the program. Next up, Wildcard Line, you are on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hi, Jordan Charles. This is Mike from Fairhope, Alabama.
Okay, Mike. Thanks for calling. Go ahead, sir.
Yeah, I do not feel the human spirit is ready to leave Earth and explore space. And let me give a realistic situation and demonstrate my point.
All right. And speak up, Michael, as loudly as you can.
Okay. Imagine sending off our grandkids or great-grandkids in a shuttle to space to die over territory or valuable resources in space. And I think that's where we are right now as humans. It's not the technology or how smart we are, which is the problem. The problem is our spiritual maturity. I think when we fix the human behavior, we'll travel the universe physically and spiritually. Till then, we're going to be earthbound and left to kill ourselves.
Well, that's an interesting viewpoint, but consider the following. All of the exploration and advancement that has happened on the Earth up to this point has been driven not by people who are unwilling to go, but those who chose to go. And the same thing will apply when we're studying and traveling in space. People who decide to go out unless they mine the asteroids or live on the moon will be people who choose to do that. And we have no right to prevent them from doing it, just as they have no right to prevent us from buying a certain type of TV dinner or driving a certain type of car. I don't think it's a matter of the human spirit being ready, because collectively, people are different. The individual spirit is what will dominate.
Yeah. And as far as the individual, you mentioned the point about $100 million to travel around toward the moon, around and back to Earth?
Yes, at the present, that's the cost. However, it will definitely come down. Pretty soon, you can expect that it won't be that much greater than the cost of a cruise somewhere.
Why? That's a heavy, hefty price. Me personally, I'm just thinking if I were to, when I came back, I'd be like, wow, imagine what I could use that $100 million for. I'd feel a little guilty about it.
Well, consider then how much you spend on a vehicle or a home. And people in another country might say, you know, we could feed our village for 30 years on that money.
You're really right.
Is a matter of perspective.
You're right. I mean, that's basically where I'm getting with where we are as humans. And I think as we develop ourselves spiritually, I think that's our ticket to travel. I don't think it's really the technology.
Oh, it never is an issue of a technology. It's a matter of the human mind and the moral judgments that we make along the way.
Mike, thanks for your call. Wildcard Line, you are on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hi, how you doing? George, I spoke to your screener, and I told her that I sent you an email. It's your email, George, at Coast Coast AM, photographs from image from NASA. And you zoom in on the image, and you see a human skull sitting there. And there's a zoom. There's two images. I sent you one of the close-up and one of a wide shot.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Yes, and another thing that I was used to work as a NASA contractor many years ago, and basically from the information that I got, the planet, if you've seen the pictures of the planet Mars, you can see a large tear in the side of the planet where an object hit it. At that point, when that planet was struck by a large large object, basically it ripped the atmosphere off that planet, and life, it was a living planet. There was life on that planet, and it was killed by, it was a kill shot that hit the planet. And there are images out there. If you type on Google search with on images, you type a human skull, you'll see actually animals. There's actually bird skulls. You could see that planet was instantly killed by this kill shot event. And there's petrified skulls of animal life on that planet as well. And what's really interesting is the human skull that I sent you. I don't know. Have you had a chance to see it yet?
No, I have not. But I'm sure you've sparked my interest now.
Yeah. Is there a way for you to look at that while you're on the air to talk to you guys?
Yes and no. I'm not going to do it during this Q&A session, but I will get to it.
Oh, okay, great. Yeah. Like I said, NASA, basically from, you know, working as a contractor many, many years ago, I was curious about images. One guy was joking about, like, the face on Mars. I thought it was a joke, but there was three pyramids that I did see in a photograph in one of the shops of pyramid structures, large pyramid structures near that so-called face. And I obtained a copy of the pyramids, and there's actually, I got a high-resolution image of it. And I talked to a friend about it, and then while I was at work, some guys ransacked my house and got that copy. So there are people taking a lot. There's people in NASA who really work hard in making sure that people don't know what is out there. And point in case, NASA, since the very beginning, has been fooling people with animations and computer high-speed graphics. A lot of the stuff that you see are computer animations. They're not the real photos. If you look on it, whenever you see on the news, it says NASA image. Look on the bottom. It says animation. You will not see the real images. They're all what they call scratched or cleaned. and you'll never see a real image. Even the resolution that you see, high-resolution images, do you think are real? No. NASA has the highest-speed graphic computers on Earth. They're so good that they can actually make a human face talking, and it will look like a human being. They could actually trick you and believe in it. They use it. National Security actually said that in case of emergency, presidential emergency, they could actually show the president standing somewhere where he isn't with a high-speed graphics computer, and you'll think it's him, but it's actually an animation. And these machines are so good that they fool anybody. So you have to be real wary about NASA unless you have someone on the inside who sneaks some images out.
Good point. Let's get Sir Charles's take on that. And also I want to talk with you about Cydonia in a moment, Sir Charles.
Okay. Well, first of all, NASA does have some extremely powerful and high-speed computers. Early on in the program, of course, the computer technology just wasn't there. And consider that most of us have a watch on our wrist with more computer capability than the whole Project Apollo had at the time. So during those times, computer graphics really didn't exist that could do what we can do today. And even up until the time, like say the early 70s, the computer capability for graphics really was not yet developed. So any of the animations you see lately, of course, they typically do identify them very clearly. And a lot of the times, they're done because there isn't a camera and a good viewpoint to get an image, such as the launch of a certain spacecraft. So, yes, we do expect that there's quite a bit of computer graphics and animation done in many of the NASA ventures and the things that they publish. But they'll always mark them very clearly, or at least they do in all the cases I'm aware of.
Okay, Cydonia, let's talk a little bit about some of the work of Richard C., the pictures are strange, of course, that he picked up off of Viking. I'm particularly interested in the pyramids as well and what he calls the city. Just your thoughts on all of that.
Well, you know, it's very interesting. I did take some time to look at some of those images after the last show, and what I find appears to be there's a glacier or an amount of subsurface ice that is fracturing and sublimating away, converting to a gaseous state. When this happens, the soil will slump down at an angle called the angle of repose, and these blocks will fracture pretty much on straight lines many times. So you will end up with what looks like alleyways or city streets, and as the soil above the glacier slumps down where the glacier is vanishing, it will produce steep, sloped sides. So the shape of a pyramid or a rectangle is very common in a case where the ice is evaporating away or sublimating away underneath the soil. You know, to me, it seems very possible that what we're seeing is an area that had a lot of water under the soil that froze. It was covered by dust, and then over the eons has been evaporating or sublimating away, and the soil is simply slumping down along those cracks or fissures.
All right, very good. Thank you for that. Next up, let's go to our West of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Yeah, good evening, George, Sir Charles. This is Marty from Fox Island, Washington State.
Hey, Marty. Thanks for calling.
You bet. Thank you. And earlier, Sir Charles was alluding to methane, formaldehyde, and one other chemical.
Ammonia.
Ammonia, thank you.
Yes.
That was in the Martian atmosphere, and I was wondering, what does that mean?
Well, you know, methane particularly is interesting because there are only two known sources for its generation. One would be geological sources underground, such as natural gas, and the other would be produced by organisms. So methane, you know, itself is interesting, but it could be from either source or both sources, so it's rather inconclusive. Now, the interesting thing about the other two gases, formaldehyde and ammonia, is that they break down very rapidly in the atmosphere of Mars due to the composition of the atmosphere and ultraviolet radiation from the sun. So if you're detecting ammonia and you're detecting formaldehyde, these are things that are produced by organic sources, and they have to be constantly renewed. So while it's possible that some of it could be venting from underground, the fact that it continues to be present, even though it's being destroyed second by second in the Martian atmosphere, it indicates to us that some activity is taking place to produce these chemicals. And those are fairly strong indicators of biological activity. So that's why they are significant.
Okay, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Okay, appreciate you being part of the program. What's next on your plate, Sir Charles? What direction are you going to continue to go in?
Well, we're going to continue with our research, and of course we're building our launch systems, and we're eventually going to reach a point where we're going to be launching the CubeSats. And the business card thing is just an interesting means of getting people involved, and it's going to help us with the development and refinement of our hardware. But eventually we're going to be selling energy systems and helping people in areas where energy is really a key issue, where you don't have traditional power sources, and we'll be working on small, low-cost launch systems. So we've got a couple of things going on top of the Mars research, which will be continuing as long as there's information available.
Do you believe, as I do, that wars will be fought over water on this planet?
Well, you know, that's an interesting thought, and in the past it has happened. As you may know, water is the one substance that determines whether human beings can live somewhere. You know, anywhere on Earth there's air, there's soil, but the lack of water can determine whether or not you're going to be able to inhabit an area, because without it, you can't raise food. You can't grow crops, or you can't raise your livestock. And so in the past, you know, water has actually been something used by empires to control populations and areas. As we begin to consume more of the fresh water on the planet, unless we come up with a way of producing more drinkable water, or something that can at least be used by our livestock and crops for farming, we're going to end up in a situation where we really don't have the ability to expand any further. So water could very easily be something that could start wars in our future. The real solution to that is cheap energy, because with energy you can distill fresh water.
Speaking of cheap energy, I saw gasoline was $1.99 a gallon here at a Shell station in St. Louis, where I am right now. And they have succeeded, Sir Charles, in playing with our minds, because they've got the thing sitting at $2 a gallon, and they're happy with that after getting it up over $3 in some areas. It's mind manipulation, and they continue to do it to us.
Well, there's another facet to it as well. You know, some of the people who think there are darker motives behind it feel that by lowering the cost of gasoline, we're actually producing a situation where people won't build alternate power systems. And that may be true in some cases, but keep in mind that gasoline is generally a transportation issue and not a power generation issue. So, you know, there's some overlap, but not a great deal. The price of gasoline really more or less affects the cost of shipping more than anything else, not the cost of producing electrical power.
Next up, let's go to our first-time caller line. Your turn on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Oh, I'm sorry. I got a little blast on the phone.
That's okay, sir.
My name's Mike. I'm from calling from Caldwell, Idaho. Are you there?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, I'm sorry. this may be a little off the track, but I had a friend that was a nuclear technician at White Sands for a long time, and he was irradiated really bad. And he died a few years ago up here in Idaho. And he used to go out in the desert, you know, and with his metal detector. And he claims he found a piece of the original casing of the first bomb that was exploded. And he had it out, you know, he had it out in his shop. And the first time I ever realized that he had something was I was out there in his shop talking to him, and he turned on a Geiger counter, and all of a sudden it went nuts. And I asked him what was that, and he pointed up over his shoulder, and there was this piece of black piece of metal about the size of a fist sitting up on a shelf. And he grinned at me and he said, "I've scoured the desert outside White Sands, and I found this piece of metal." And he claims it was part of the casing of the first atomic bomb that was exploded. And I think the piece of metal is still on his property. I don't know how many times I sat there, you know, before he told me. Now I have skin problems, you know.
Hmm. You do? You know?
Yeah. And he had extremely bad psoriasis. You know, I mean, he was unhealthy. He got a government, you know, disability. There was an accident in the lab that he was working at. and he was discharged. You know, he was a nuclear technician, and he was let go, and he was on disability the rest of his life. But I've got skin conditions now that dermatologists can't figure out why. You know, why I've got my skin breaking out all the time. You know, and I think that piece of metal is still sitting there in his widow's, you know, on his widow's property.
Okay, now, if you have a piece of material that is that radioactive, it's definitely a danger. But first of all, let me step back a little. The first atomic bomb that was exploded, like all the atomic bombs since, absolutely vaporized all of the material. So you cannot possibly have a piece of the casing because the bomb and the tower it was mounted on
gone.
Were converted to vapor. They're absolutely gone. Now, it's possible you have a piece of something else related to the nuclear program at the time, but it certainly couldn't be a piece of the original atomic bomb or any atomic bomb, because once you explode the bomb, it literally vaporizes everything. There's nothing left solid. So if you have a piece of material, if that's radioactive, you need to have it disposed of properly because it could be a serious health problem. I certainly wouldn't want anything like that around me. And, you know, I've done a lot of nuclear work. So if you can get a hold of it, get rid of it.
We'll be back with some final calls in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Sir Charles Schultz, our guest. We'll take your final calls as well. Very fast program. I've got to compliment you, Charles, on the work that you've done and the meticulousness of the kind of effort you have put into everything you've been working on. Very well done.
Well, thank you. And all that information will be very shortly available in book form. And there's just a huge gallery of material that isn't even on my site. It'll be greatly detailed there.
Excellent. What are we going to call the book? Title yet?
It'll be A Fossil Hunter's Guide to Mars.
I love it. To the phones we go, west of the Rockies. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello, this is Jeff from Portland, Oregon.
Hey, Jeff. Jeff, did you feel a little rumbling an hour or so
ago?
No,
I didn't feel it at all.
Okay, there's a 2-6 out that way. Go ahead.
Yeah, my question is about the carbon ladder going into space, and I find it really intriguing, but my question is, with the jet stream blowing from west to east at, you know, 200 miles an hour or more, and then meandering from north to south, what are the wind loads that would be created? And would the carbon ladder withstand those kinds of forces?
Well, that's a very good question. And, you know, it's going to depend on the cross-section that is presented to the wind. Many of the designs that I've seen discussed use orientation into the face of the wind to try and get rid of that effect. So the wind loading would actually be minimized by aiming in a leading edge of the ribbon, and it's not going to be like a rope, but more like a flat ribbon, aiming the edge of the ribbon into the wind. So it'll be something that's dynamically adjusted.
And so as the objects go up, would they be configured in a similar fashion such that they would be narrow like a ribbon too, so they wouldn't have a big cross-section?
Well, actually, some of them can be quite tall and narrow, almost shaped like a rocket, and others are actually very flat. So it really depends on your application.
Okay, and the last question associated with that, is it possible that the winds could get so strong such that it could actually, you know, since it's anchored in space, the force of the wind, could it, you know, actually blow it back into the orbit, you know, out of orbit and into the Earth's gravity and pull it down?
Well, so far, simulations on the models show that that won't happen.
Okay.
And, of course, you're going to try and pick an area where hurricane force winds aren't going to be an issue. We can actually, you know, put the thing pretty much anywhere we want it in the ocean. So we have the ability to decide where we're going to put the thing. And keep in mind that hurricanes don't typically occur on the equator.
How thick, Charles, would this cable be?
That will depend entirely on how much load you're trying to lift. Typically, you know, a few millimeters.
Yeah, this will have to be bigger than that, I think.
Well, actually, you know, the tensile strength of the carbon is incredible.
That's strong. It is strong. There's no doubt about that. First time caller line, you're on the air. Hi there.
Good evening, or good morning, I should say.
Yeah, sure thing.
I wanted to discuss some of the stuff about power generation, something I've been interested in for a long time. And one very ancient thing and one very recent thing. I'm in Raleigh, North Carolina. And recently, within the last few years, we have a huge office building now that used to be a manufacturing plant that generates its own power for power, lighting, air conditioning, everything from solar generation, and actually co-generates back into the utility system. It's pretty high tech, and it works very, very well. Has huge potential. And something from way, way back, probably 45 years ago or so, there was an article, I believe, in Popular Mechanics about, I think, the University of Georgia that built a solar house with a solar collector, a great big banana-shaped thing out in the yard, and they actually wound up boiling water when they first tried to use it for their collection and went to cottonseed oil with a closed system, and they could generate 1,000-degree temperatures with this thing and store it and actually develop the kitchen range with tubing instead of, you know, electrical elements to cook with. They couldn't broil anything, but they could actually cook in an oven or in a range with, you know, with copper coils and temperature controls. Pretty interesting, considering it was probably around, well, between 40 and 50 years ago. I used to get Popular Science, Popular Mechanics and things like that, Popular Electronics, and read all that stuff back then. I'm an engineer myself. But the office building that has been done recently, a good friend of mine was foreman on the project with a construction company and kind of got very familiar with how the system operated. And it's pretty complex, but actually it's a huge building. I'd say on the order of 600,000 to 700,000 square feet. And it typically generates way more power than it uses.
Well, you know, in a large building, your air conditioning and heating costs can be much lower because the interior volume has a very small surface area compared to it. Obviously, if you had a very large flat building with like one story, the heating would be a real problem. If you made the building, you know, like 3 or 4 stories thick, then you'd have less surface area and there'd be less of a heat load on it. So on a larger building, you actually come out way ahead. If you have a system that is at any significant scale, it's typically not solar cells unless your electrical use in a building is not really that large. So larger volume, smaller area buildings can actually do quite well with solar panels. Of course, the system we're working on isn't solar panels at all, but completely different. However, you certainly can operate in many parts of the world at a net gain.
Sir Charles, is your solar generator pretty silent or is it a loud machine?
It's actually moderately quiet. Some of the tests we've done show that the noise levels are very low and quite acceptable. Until we get the completed full-scale model running, we can't give a real figure on it, but I don't think it'd be any more obtrusive than the water pump on your pool filter.
East of the Rockies, welcome to Coast. You're on the air. Hi there.
Oh, hi. Yeah. Sir Charles, you mentioned earlier about the Chinese. I was 2 questions on that. I'm curious, do you think they'll make it to the moon within 10 years? And another important question is, how are they getting their technology so fast, it seems like? Do you think some of it's from their spying sources?
And do you mean a manned flight to the moon?
Say again?
Oh, yes.
Do you mean a manned flight? Is that what you're asking?
Right, a manned flight.
Okay. All right.
Yes, I do believe that they'll get there in 10 years or less. When you consider how we started with almost nothing and in 9 years made it to the moon with manned flights, then you have to consider how much more technical knowledge is available in the world for free today. That's a direct spinoff from that sort of thing that we had to learn, you know, in the 1960s. Then it makes perfect sense that they'll get there in 10 years, absolutely. And the reason that they're getting such a high level of development so rapidly isn't necessarily due to spying, because the basic experiments in rocketry are actually quite simple. If you have the billions and billions of dollars in hand that a government such as China has, then there's no problem with getting experts in nearly any type of field to work for you. And as you begin developing and testing your hardware, you will develop technologies very rapidly. So it's not a surprise to me. I don't think spying is involved at all. I think they're really just going through the experiments and learning what we did at a greatly accelerated pace because of what's already known today.
Okay, thank you.
Great, thank you. How about the rocketry of Iran? How advanced do you think they really are, Charles?
Well, you know, what's available in Iran is basically what's available in weapon systems. Any weapon that's been purchased by them can be disassembled and studied, and a lot can be learned from that. I don't know what specifically they're developing. I don't know what their capabilities are at this time, but I think that for the most part it would be pretty much limited to what they can see in missile systems that they can buy as weapons on the open market.
Same as North Korea?
Well, yeah, very much so. And it didn't take very long to scale those systems up. But understand that the systems that you build do require precision materials and precision machining, and those are conditions that can be difficult to maintain in a lower-tech country. Of course, then again, we started at the bottom, and they are too, and anybody can do it given dedication and some funding and time.
I tell you what, governments on this planet are going to have to get a handle on everything, because I would say within 50 years, so many countries will have nuclear technology that we won't be able to keep track of it.
Well, that's true. You know, the developments are very rapid. And the other thing that makes it very difficult to control or even keep tabs on is the fact that for nuclear weapons, the most difficult thing is separating out your fuel material, getting the enriched fuel. We have a number of technologies that have emerged in recent years and then were quietly submerged that allow people to build very small machines that can enrich fissionable masses very, very easily. Some of them use lasers instead of miles of diffusion tubing, and they can be operated silently and cleanly and not produce a great deal of waste. So this is a real threat. You know, we have to be careful about some of the things we develop, not because we're trying to suppress technology, but because of the things that they can lead to.
Good point. Next up, west of the Rockies, your turn on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George, and hello, Sir Charles. This is Garth in Seattle, and I had a question about a guest at Arbell interviews. His name was Neil Adams, and he had a thing called the Growing Earth Theory, and he used examples of Martian landscape on his website to show how that would be possible, you know, with Mars as well as other planets. And he makes a great case, I thought, and I wanted to know what you thought of it.
Well, you know, I don't see any real evidence of anything like a planet expanding. Consider that if the Earth were actually growing, then the same mechanisms would probably apply to the other planets as well. And so because their masses would be changing over geological time, we'd see some great disturbances in the orbits. They wouldn't be stable the way we see now. So that's one piece of evidence against it. The other is, what's the source of the mass? It's certainly not from asteroids and meteors and space dust landing on a planet, or we'd be bombarded to death all the time. It would take a significant amount of material. And some people, you know, have suggested that the growth was occurring in the core of the Earth. But again, what's the source of the mass? Everything we know happens well within the laws of science and physics. And, you know, you don't just simply change the laws of physics to account for a pretty theory. You have to have some sort of supporting evidence. So it sounds interesting, but I don't see any really, for me, any convincing evidence that that's happening.
One last question. Richard C. Hogan has an article on his website that refers to an axis running through the universe, that the universe has an axis, and would that point to maybe a toroidally shaped universe?
Well, it's possible. You know, people have debated on the shape and size of the universe for quite a while, and recent instruments and readings have shown us quite a number of things. You know, some have suggested the universe might have a geodesic shape, like an icosahedron. But an axis of the universe, that's kind of a tricky thing to address, because if the universe were rotating, then it would put a real limit on its potential size, because things at the periphery of the rotation would be moving very, very close to the speed of light all the time. So I don't think that the universe as a whole has much in the way of rotation. And keep in mind that there is no center point for our universe that you can travel to or point to. The center of our universe is actually, it's extended in a fourth dimension away from any, it's kind of like the surface of a balloon. If you were on the surface of a balloon, you couldn't touch the center of the balloon because it's not on the surface. And our universe is like the surface. And in the past of our universe, the point that it expanded from, that's forever out of our reach. It's kind of like in the center of the balloon. And that's a kind of a poor model, but it kind of gives you a visualization of why we wouldn't really see a rotation.
Do you believe in extraterrestrial life, Sir Charles? Intelligent.
Absolutely. Yeah, I've found fossils on Mars, so I couldn't possibly say no to that.
Wildcard Line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, how you doing, Sir Charles? Just
yes,
one quick question.
Sure thing.
Just one kid, question. You know your CubeSats that you're talking about, they sound very interesting, and I'd like to know if it would be possible to personally own one and then control it from your garage.
Well, yes, it is. Absolutely it is. In fact, you can go online, put CubeSat in Google, and you'll find the whole specification and a place that actually sells kits to put CubeSats together. As far as control goes, you're going to need some means of uplinking communications to the satellite and receiving communications. So you might have to make an arrangement with some sort of communication system or an organization that does satellite communications for you. But yes, you know, there's no reason why you couldn't sit right in your garage with your laptop and use the internet to control your satellite and get data from it.
And one quick thing, can you what do the CubeSats actually do? Are there examples of certain kind of CubeSats that would do certain sort of things in kit form?
Well, you know, I don't know what they provide in the kits as far as guidelines, but most of the people who are interested in the concept have a specific task in mind. For instance, some are just as simple as putting a camera in it and getting images of the Earth from orbit, or, you know, perhaps putting field sensors and measuring the density of the Earth's magnetic field, or any number of things. You can do scientific experiments, or you can simply fly vanity items if you want. So there's really no limit. It's limited only by your imagination.
Well, you're an incredible person, sir. I'm totally impressed with your intellect. It's amazing. Have a good night, George, too. Thank you.
Okay, appreciate you being part of the program.
Thanks.
Sir Charles, as we move ahead with just a few more minutes left on the program, we didn't talk really about Hubble. We talked briefly in the beginning, but I wanted to wrap up this hour with the incredible find that Hubble has given us some of the best pictures I've ever seen on any celestial object, ever. And it would be nice just to save it for just a little bit longer, huh?
Well, it is a very, very functional satellite, and even though there were some misgivings about it in the beginning and there were a number of things that needed to be corrected, it has proved to be one of the most valuable and productive pieces of space hardware ever built. We have received such a mountain of data from Hubble and learned so many things about the universe that from a historical standpoint alone, it is really an icon. And yes, it's a shame to see the thing end up, you know, in a fiery reentry. But the fact is, we now have so much better hardware. I mean, we've had 20 years to develop, you know, even more than that, to develop far better hardware. And so we're really at a point where we have to decide when we cut the ties. For the same cost of servicing the Hubble, we could probably put up three or four smaller satellites in spaced orbits that generate a much larger image aperture so that we get 10 or 100 times the resolution.
Let's go to our final caller, first-time caller. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. Go ahead. We only have about a minute left for you.
Okay, cool. Hey, I want to ask about the deepest hole in Siberia.
I'm sorry, I don't know much about that at all.
Which one is that?
Well, I just wanted to...
Maybe you're talking about Tunguska. You never know. No.
Well, Tunguska really, as you know, is not really a hole. It's just a large area that was hit by a blast around 1908, and it appears to have been a comet or something that detonated in the upper atmosphere.
He might be confused with an old show we did a long time ago called Mel's Hole.
Well, that's a possibility.
Which seems to go down until the end of time. Sir Charles, we're out of time. Your website, xenotechresearch.com. How'd you come up with that name?
Well, Xeno meaning outer and tech for technology, and when you consider some of the strange things we do, Xenotech is actually a very apt name. And doing research in robotics and artificial intelligence and energy and space, we have to think of things that really are out there.
All right. Well, thanks for being on the program, Sir Charles.
Well, it was a pleasure, as always.
This guy is fantastic. Look, as we wrap things up, I was sitting in for Art Bell tonight as he had some technical problems in the Philippines. And I will be back with you for the rest of this week. We've got a great list of guests for you, including Thursday. Circle the calendar because Steve Quayle is on with an incredible story of some extraterrestrials that may have been found on the planet. I mean, it's really a cool story. For Karis Coburn, Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Gina Salvati, Ross Mitchell, Ian Punnett, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesure, and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.